Quantum Marketing Radio, the marketing podcast for insurance agents and financial professionals.
And welcome to another episode of Quantum Marketing Radio. I'm your host, Louis Hillman, alongside the Leverage Marketing Guy.
Hey, Jeff Thompson here.
And we have the pleasure of having Mike Castelnick joining us on the show today. Mike founded the 5Q Marketing System and has a very unique approach to the sales process. He joins us from his office in Rochester, Minnesota. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Louis. Hey, Jeff. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing, Mike?
Very good. Thanks for asking.
Well, thanks for being on the podcast today.
So, yeah, give us just your story, how you got your start in our industry and how it brought you to where you are today.
Sure. Well, I started in the industry in 1989. I was an executive at Best Buy and decided I did not want to do that anymore. So, left the Best Buy in 1989, started in the financial industry, and struggled for the first 7-8 years, as I think a lot of people tend to do is when they first come to the industry, trying to get their feet on the ground and figure out how to get in front of people and get those people to become clients. So I never really made more than $50,000 a year in that first 7-8 years. And then a light bulb kind of went on in the ninth year, and I went from $50,000 to $356,000 to $667,000 to $967,000 in 3 years. So I made almost $1 million a year in that third year after the light bulb went on and figured out how to get in front of people and then get those people to leave their current advisor, whether they be a do-it-yourselfer and they're leaving Fidelity or they have an advisor and move over to myself. So back in 2000, after I was able to do that, a lot of movers and shakers in the industry coaxed me into actually teaching other advisors to do the exact same thing that I did. So I've actually been coaching now since the year 2000 financial advisors.
And the big key to your strategy is a term you call motivational or psychological interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
And talk to us about what role your wife played in helping kind of turn that light bulb on for you.
Yeah, that's funny you bring that up. So really, you know, that first 7-8 years, I actually quit the eighth year in the business because after making $50,000 a year for 8 years, I was like, this is not working. So I actually quit. My best client and my wife actually talked me into staying in the industry. And my wife said, well, just tell me what the problem you're having here. And I said, well, all these people here in Rochester, they're dumb as stumps. I mean, I'm showing them what I'm a CFP. I'm building these beautiful financial plans for them. They should be in the Smithsonian. They're so perfect. I mean, they're awesome. And the people all say they're awesome. And then they say, thanks for showing this to us. And then they take it back to the guy who created all the problems for them in the first place. And then she, Michelle, being a, you know, I don't know, if, so being a doctor of psychology at the clinic, she said, you know what, Mike, a known evil is better than an unknown good. And I said, what do you mean by that? She goes, well, why would they move to you when they're virtually looking at you as the same thing as what they currently have? And all they need to do is just take your plan right back to them. People want to do things the easiest way or the hardest way. I said, the easiest way. She goes, well, isn't it easier just to take yourself back to them? I was like, the light bulb went on. I said, oh, you know what? I got to figure out how to get them to leave their guy, because this whole beauty pageant mentality of me saying, "Hey, my product is better, my proposal is better, my financial plan is better, my software is better," was not working because all my competitors had virtually the same thing. So when that light bulb went off, I figured out finally after 8 years of blaming. I mean, the real epiphany was this. After 8 years, 9 years of, seven or 8 years of blaming everybody but myself, it was like, oh, these people here in Rochester are dumb as stumps, or oh, the products aren't very good, or oh, the economy isn't conducive to this, or oh, the regulations are killing me, or oh, it was always everybody's fault but my own. When I finally hit rock bottom, and I said, you know what? If I have something that people want, and if I don't have something people want, I better find something people want. So if I have something that people want, and the only thing between them and what they want is me, I mean, the only common denominator in all those people I saw in those first 8 years was me. So apparently it wasn't the economy, it wasn't the products, it wasn't anything else, it was me. So what I started to do at that point is I started to tape my meetings, and I was just horrified on how I would get on and what I call, or I would talk to people, and then what I call tell, sell, preach, teach. So I was constantly preaching at them, trying to teach them, telling them everything. And what I learned was that, you know, these people, they don't want, you can't change people's minds. The only person who can change somebody's mind is themselves. So I went back to Michelle and said, I don't know how aware you guys are of psychology, but there's several disciplines. I mean, there's a multitude of disciplines of psychology, and she's a behavioralist, which is actually more hearing people. But I said, how is there any branch of psychology that I can look at to get people to change their to change what they're doing? And she goes, well, there's a branch called motivational interviewing that began back in the 1970s that's having wonderful success, and right now I think there's over 40,000 practitioners of motivational interviewing, clinical practitioners of motivational interviewing, and what they do is they help people change, and what they help people change from is their bad habits. So it gets people who are addicted to drugs off of drugs, it gets people who are addicted to gambling off gambling, it gets people who have self-destructive habits to stop doing that. And what they learned was that the more you try to, well, I'll ask you guys, the more you tell a drunk to stop drinking, what's he going to do?
He's going to keep drinking.
Yeah, the more you tell a gambler quit gambling, what's he going to do?
He's going to double down.
Double down, that's right. So it's hurting your family. It's hurting you. They're full of all sorts of rationalizations why it's not. So motivational interviewing discovered that, you know what, it's a methodology of walking a patient, and in our case, a client, through making changes where they tell themselves, they do self-discovery on why they need to make that change. So when I started to utilize that, that's why my income, you know, that first year going from 50 to 356, it really, I didn't see any increase for the first 6 months because I was trying to figure out how to make this thing work, and taping my meetings and listening to them, I started to see what was not working and what was working, and then I saw an exponential increase in my income from 357, 67, and 967 as I basically polished up the whole process. So it became a process where every single person that came through my office was taken through a process almost exactly the same. It didn't matter if they were had $3 million or had $100,000. Didn't matter if they were 60 years old or 75 years. Didn't matter if they were a single lady or a married couple of 40 years. That they were all taken through the exact same process. And when I did that, I was able to figure out exactly what worked and what didn't work. And my partner here, Jeff Freeberg, actually makes the analogy. Are you guys familiar with the movie Groundhog Day?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So what he does is, by the beginning, he's just totally flummoxed by life, right? It's just nothing works out for him. It seems like he's always getting whacked upside the head. But by the end, after he's lived that same day over, 1,000 times, how perfect is his day?
As perfect as you can get.
Yeah, as perfect as you can get. And he, did he design that, or did he simply learn from each day that he lived how to fix problems that were, so instead of stepping into that hole with up to his kneecap in water, he learned to avoid that hole. In order to make the Andy McDowell's character like him, he learned what she liked and didn't like. So by the end of the movie, his life was perfectly smooth. And it wasn't because he was smart. It wasn't because he designed it that way. All he did was fix one problem after another problem, until there was no problems in that day. And that's kind of what happened with the 5Q selling system, is that we just fixed one problem after another problem until there were no more problems to fix. That the process went smoothly, where the client went from loving their guy or being a do-it-yourselfer into asking us. We never asked them. They asked us to take control of all their money. So we didn't design it. The client actually designed it by telling us what they liked and didn't like. So we just fixed problem after problem after problem. And the methodology we use is motivational interviewing, where they tell us everything, we never tell them anything. And that's a hard thing for salespeople or financial advisors, because we love to listen to people, or we love to, quote-unquote, educate people.
Can you walk us through an example of motivational interviewing? I just want to be able to really wrap my hands around how you are implementing that tactic when you are in front of a client.
Sure. It's what we do is
put us on the hot seat.
Yeah. Okay. So, give me an example of an objection that you guys come up with, or you think that advisors come up with, that they run across.
I ran into one just recently. An agent had a client with a fairly large case, and they were concerned about the liquidity of the life insurance, so access Perfect. To the cash.
Perfect. So the first thing we teach them is this, is that you immediately go into, or first of all, feel, felt, found. In today's world, when you say, oh, I understand how you feel. I used to feel this, I felt the same way myself. And what I found, if you do that crap, guess how long before that client sniffs out what you're doing and puts up a mile-high brick wall.
Yeah, they know that one's a sales technique.
Yeah. So what we teach the guys is that when anybody gives us an objection, the first thing we need to do is agree with them. And not kind of agree with them, not mostly agree with them, but agree with them 150%. So the first thing we're going to do is say, absolutely. I mean, why would I put my money into anything that's going to lock my money up? I mean, that's crazy. We don't know what life is going to throw us. I mean, for all we know, our kid's going to need money. Next month, or the car is going to break down, or there's going to be a health problem. So there's no way I would ever put my money into something. So when you say you don't want to put something and put money into this because it's going to lock your money up, absolutely. That'd be crazy to put your money into something that's going to lock it up. I mean, I would never do that myself. In fact, one time I did that, and lo and behold, I thought, hey, you know what? I'm not going to need this money for a year. I might as well go ahead and put it into this investment. And because I hadn't needed that money for 35 years. And guess what happened? As soon as I put it in there, less than a month later, boom, I needed that money. So when you say you don't want to put in something that's illiquid, I totally agree. I mean, you're talking to the choir here. You're preaching, you're singing to the choir here. So you see, now out of role play, the first thing I'm going to do is what? Tell them they're right. Because here's the thing. Do you think, Jeff, when they gave that objection, do you think that, what do you think, first of all, do they think that advisor was going to like them saying that?
Probably not.
No. So when we do something like that, what do you think is happening to our pulse rate and our blood pressure?
It's going up.
And what's happening to our breath rate and we're in the fight flight physiology at that point.
Right,
so
yeah.
If my blood pressure's up, breathing rate's up, my pulse rate's up, what's happening to my ability to listen?
It's gone away just because they feel like they're in a conflict now. So
that's right. They feel like they're in a conflict, getting ready for a fight.
Yeah.
So what do you think is happening to the advisor when he hears something that he doesn't like? He's either mad or panicked. So what's happening to his blood pressure, his pulse rate, his ability to listen?
All the same things.
So now we've got two people who are not listening to each other, but instead already concocting their answer to what the other person is going to throw at them. So I'm no longer even thinking about, I know he's going to tell me that, try to come up with some sort of excuse, so I'm already thinking about what I'm going to say when he gives me that excuse. So instead, if you totally agree with him, I give the visual cue of this. I don't know if you ever watched cartoons when you're a kid, but when the cartoon character would go, and when something surprising happened, he'd shake his head and his lips would all flop around. It's like, what just happened here? So when you do that, they expect you to actually disagree with them and try to talk them out of that particular objection. But when you agree with the objection, what happens? First of all, first response, what happens?
It's like they're putting their guard down.
What did you just say? Yeah. And what do you think the value of that would be? When you say, if they're thinking, wait, what just happened here? You're not doing what I thought you were going to do. What do you think the value of that would be?
It's got to be pretty valuable just because it's breaking a pattern that they've probably been accustomed to for years.
That's exactly right. It breaks the paradigm. It breaks the pattern. So at least now we can, that brick wall shatters and we're starting from ground zero because they're like, what's happening here? Then the second thing that's happening is on both sides of the net here. Because if we don't do this, what we're going to have is a volley, right? I'm going to volley it to you, you're going to volley it back. And I volley it to you, volley it back. But what happens here is instead, now that we've broken that paradigm, I'm now going to explain to them why what they said was absolutely true.
Because they can actually listen to you now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Because they actually are in a mode where they can actually listen to you, and they're not in that fight mode now.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then as I go on and start to talk for 2 or 3 minutes, making their point for them, then what they start to think is, oh, this guy gets me. Oh, he's on my side. Oh, he's a friend, not a foe. He's not trying to shove something down my throat. So at that point, you know, we'll listen to friendly people. We'll listen to people in our camp. What we won't listen to, I don't care how reasonable you are, but what we won't listen to is somebody who's not in our camp. Try to get a true blue Democrat to listen to a true blue Republican. Ain't going to happen. Now, it's not until the Republican argues the Democrat's point of view for 2 or 3 minutes, or the Democrat argues the Republican's point of view for 2 or 3 minutes, that they're going to think, oh, this guy gets me. He's on our side. At that point, guess what can happen? A reasonable conversation. So, and that's a hard thing to teach guys, because what a lot of guys think, oh my gosh, I'm validating their, I'm digging a hole here. How am I going to get out of this hole? I can't do that. But the thing is, you know, you're not even going to have a chance if you don't dig that hole. And what you want to do is dig that hole so deep that they start to help you out of that hole. So once they're convinced that I'm on their side, then we're going to use the word and, not but. Because if I get on their side for 2 or 3 minutes and I'm arguing the point of view for 2 or 3 minutes, and then I say, but, what instantly happens in that past 2 or 3 minutes?
You just negated it pretty much.
Yeah, because when human beings, when we hear the word but, we hear what? That's all wrong.
Now that's not true, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then here's the funny thing. If you do it that way and then you just actually overcome the objection the way you would normally overcome the objection, it works more often than not. So what didn't work before works now. Why? Because when we overcome objections, are we generally doing it in a reasonable way? Or are we totally out to lunch?
Most agents respond with, you know, lots of logical reasons why.
Yeah, the reasons.
Yeah.
Reasons. So yeah. Why do you think it would work after you would spend 2 or 3 minutes telling them right versus if you just launch into that right away?
Well, I mean, now they're in a more receptive mode just because they're not fighting you. They're feeling like they can trust you and that you have that understanding, like you said, that you understand.
That's exactly right. So there's a number of reasons for it. Number one is that you're in that mode where they think I'm with a friend. Another thing is the longer you do that and the more animated you are in the defense of their point of view, if you do that for three or 4 minutes, by the time you get to 3 or 4 minutes, guess what they can't remember?
Their objection.
Their objection. So now when you talk reasonably about how to overcome their objection, they don't have to admit that they're wrong. Because how many people like to admit that they're wrong?
Nobody.
Zero, yeah.
And I've been in a conversation where halfway through the conversation, I realize I'm in the wrong, but guess what I won't do?
You're going down with the sinking ship.
I'll go down in flames. I will go down in flames, right, Louis? Rather than give them the self-satisfaction of knowing that they one-up me, I'll go down with the ship, right?
It's like my buddies and I battling about fantasy football debates. I know I'm wrong, but I'm not letting them know I'm wrong.
Amen, because then we both know you're right. There's always that doubt. There's that little doubt in the other person's mind if I stand my ground the whole time. He's not going to be 100% sure he's right. He might be 99.9% sure he's right. But then that's how human nature is. So if we put enough real estate between when they give the objection, and if I do a very animated discussion of why or soliloquy about why their fear or concern is right, if I go long enough, they forget what they even brought up that conversation in the first place. Now, once you get skilled, though, at motivational interviewing, what you're going to do, though, instead of just overcoming objection the way you would normally do it, is you're going to say absolutely, spend 3 or 4 minutes getting on their side, explaining why they're right, use the word and, not the word but, and then you're going to go through a series of small questions to have them come to the conclusion that they need to come to. So I would say I'd be telling them why illiquidity was, a huge issue, and you shouldn't invest in anything that's illiquid, and then I would, after 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, then I'm going to say, and that's why we keep all of our money in a savings account.
So Mike,
yes. So
I've got a question for you.
Sure.
This seems like, since it's so contrary and counterintuitive to what most salespeople have learned over their entire career from all the traditional, you know, sales trainers out there,
Yeah.
How hard is this for somebody to implement? Is this, you know, kind of a painful process to get people to change and get off of their existing habits as well?
That's a great question, Jeff. So here's the thing. First of all, I'm going to agree wholeheartedly with you with the fact that it is contrarian to what everything that I teach at 5Q is contrarian to what's been taught for years. Could you jot down that question? Because I want to. Can I go off on a tangent here a second? So
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so we can come back. So let me tell you why what's changed. So everything I do is the opposite of what most advisors, myself included, sales trained, have been trained in sales for decades. And it's because things have changed. I've got guys on the system now that used to write, you know, $10 million, $15 million a year that are struggling to write three now. And they're not any worse than they were before. They're doing the exact same thing. They are awesome salespeople. So what do you think's changed? And they were writing that $10, $15 million back in 2001, 2002, 2003, but now they're struggling to write $3 million in production. So what do you think's changed in the last 15 years?
I'm guessing the market has sort of picked up on all the sales techniques that people are using, and they can spot it.
Well, to a large degree, you're right. Because right now what we're seeing is the greatest generation is really almost too old for us to work anymore, to with anymore. Now we're working with boomers. And guess what electrical appliance boomers grew up with?
The microwave?
Yeah, that. What before that? What do we spend hours in front of?
Television.
Television. What's on television?
Lots of commercials.
Yeah, so what are boomers awesome at? They've been lied to how many times in their lives by television ads?
Hours and hours of it. So,
guess how sensitive they are to that.
Yeah, I'm assuming they're pretty attuned to it.
Yeah. The other thing that's happened is this. We also now have a what else has changed in the last 16 years? Drastically.
Internet.
Google.
Internet, Google, exactly. So, you know, if you walk down a block now, your block at home, and you knock on every single door, and you get into a casual conversation with them, how many of those of your neighbors would view themselves as financial experts, investment experts?
Probably zero.
So you need to go knock on those doors, Jeff, because guess how many think that they're financial experts?
Well, I suppose there's plenty of do-it-yourselfers, so.
Even the ones that aren't do-it-yourselfers think they're experts. Why? I have a block of we have block parties, and I can't even open my mouth because guess what all the men want to circle around and talk about. If it's not football season, guess what they want to talk about?
How their
frigging investment clubs, and they're talking about, oh, I bought Chick-fil-A, oh, I bought, I'm a genius, I bought Tesla, I'm a genius, I bought, blah, 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 I'm a genius.
Makes
everybody
sense.
Thinks they're a frigging genius.
Yeah, makes sense.
So and if they don't think they're a friggin' genius, they can instantly find information where?
Online.
So yeah. Back, you know, 2001, 2002, if you were an awesome salesperson, guess what? You'd sell them on pawn, they'd look at each other and say, well, you don't seem reasonable. I don't, you know, what he's saying seems to make sense. I don't know. What do you think, Martha? I don't know. What do you think, Bob? Well, I guess, well, he seems like a trustworthy guy. Let's just go ahead and do it. Now, if that same conversation occurred, they'd say, yeah, I mean, it seems to make sense. Let me think about it. Give me a call tomorrow, Mr. Advisor. And what would they do as soon as the advisor left?
They're going to go search on the Internet.
And I don't care what you type in the Internet. The first page is going to be filled with glowing. I don't care if you're looking up REITs, fixed annuities, managed money. I mean, go ahead and type in managed money, managed money fees, and guess what the whole first page is going to say?
It's a scam.
You're paying a fee, you're an idiot. Article after article after article. If you put up fixed index annuity, what's going to come up? If you put in, I mean, it doesn't matter what investment you put up, what sells? Hey, this is a great thing, or this thing sucks?
Yeah, it's going to be the negative, obviously.
Yeah. So they go home and they do what? Geez, I thought I made a good thing we looked at Google, because holy moly. We could have really done something stupid here. And then they call up and say what? Cancel everything and need to think about it. Of course, that never happens to our advisor, does it?
Yeah, happens all the time.
Happens all the time. So you have to avoid that. And here's how you avoid that. It's with motivational interviewing. If they explain to me for an hour, they explain to me for an hour and a half, why whatever we're talking about makes sense, what do they not feel the need to do?
Google it. Go vet that, yeah.
If they spend an hour and a half explaining to me why something makes sense and their brother-in-law, because if they're not an expert, guess who is an expert?
Their cousin, their brother.
Their cousin, their brother-in-law, the neighbor, their guy at work.
Right.
So if they explain to me for an hour and a half why something is the way it is, and then their cousin tries to tell them that they're an idiot, guess what they tell their cousin?
Well, they don't need to hear
yeah, exactly. Because what he's doing is the cousin using motivational interview? Or is he trying to say, I'm smarter than you are, I know something that you don't know? And how does that work in today's world?
It's going to be more of a confrontation at that point.
Yeah, so they dig in their heels. The same way we said that if you tell a drunk to quit drinking, that drunk will dig in his heels. The more the cousin, if you do it the right way with motivational interviewing, where the client discovers for themselves the answer and describes it in five different ways why it makes sense. If they explain five different ways why this is liquid or more liquid than what they're currently doing, or why, you know, why the liquidity is an issue, if they explain to me over five times and then they go home and somebody says, you know, that's not very liquid, what are they going to tell their cousin?
Well, I think they're going to reject it because it's going to cause cognitive dissonance for them. So
there you go. That's exactly right. Yeah. But if instead I sell them on it, sell them on the fact that it's liquid, I do all the talking, I do all the convincing, I'm a fabulous presenter, and I present to them why this is a great deal and they shouldn't ignore the liquidity, they're going to think, yeah, that's absolutely right. They're going to go home, and then as soon as they run into the cousin who says, oh, that's illiquid, and then he makes his case, who are they going to believe, you or the cousin?
Well, they're not completely convinced, really, at that point, so it's easier to sway them, I would assume.
Yeah, it's easier to sway them. And in fact, what happens is they're going to believe the cousin. Does the cousin make any money?
Right. No.
No, he doesn't. So who's going to believe? The guy's going to make money or the guy's not going to make money?
Yeah, the guy without a vested interest. So, yeah.
So that's one thing. The other thing is this. Is if the decision becomes difficult, I don't care what the decision is, if it becomes difficult, what do we as human beings?
We do nothing.
We do nothing. So either the cousin's going to win or the cousin's not going to win. The client's going to get confused, and what's going to happen?
Nothing.
Nothing. Either way, we get nothing. But if instead we use motivational interviewing where it takes more work, but if we use that motivational interviewing where the client answers questions and it comes to their own conclusion, then the cousin's attack will not work. It'll actually be to our benefit, because the more they attack, the more our client will what? Dig in.
Yeah.
Now, is it hard? Yeah, it's hard. Anything's hard. I mean, is speaking Spanish hard?
You bet.
But if you don't know, how many millions of people speak Spanish?
Probably tens of millions. So.
Yeah. So it comes down to do we? It's not. Is it difficult? Because push comes to shove, learning Spanish is not difficult. If they said you're going to die in a year, you don't learn Spanish, guess how many people will be able to learn Spanish?
I think we'd probably hit everyone.
I think we get everybody. It's not that hard. It's just a matter of what? It requires work, and then you have to decide, am I willing to put in the work to do that? But I'll give you an example of, you asked how hard it is. Here's what I tell guys when they tell me it's hard. For example, motivational interviewing is about asking questions. We don't tell, sell, preach, or teach. Instead, we ask questions. Let the client come to their own conclusions. And the guy goes, yeah, but I've been telling and selling and preaching and teaching for years. And can we agree that's how salespeople have been selling for years, is telling, selling, preaching, and teaching?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah. So asking questions is hard. Now, and I always get a guy when I'm training people, oh, no, Mike, I ask questions. I ask questions all the time. And here's the kind of questions he asks. Hey, do you understand this, Louie?
Yes.
Do you see why this makes sense, Jeff?
Yes.
Guess what those questions are worth?
Those are worthless questions.
And they are, Louie. And why are those worthless?
I mean, yes, no is just, it's an affirmation. It's not that the person really understands it.
That's right, because yes can mean all sorts of things.
Yes, I want you to just be done.
Shut
talking
up.
To me.
Yes. So yes can mean, I had a bad day at work. I come home, my wife's talking to me, because she wants to tell me what went on with the day, and I'm looking at the sports scores over her shoulder. I'm saying, yeah. Am I listening to a single word she's saying? So yes can be a place filler. Yes could mean if I'm a Democrat and my neighbor's a Republican and I'm out clipping my bushes, do I want to get into a huge argument with my neighbor that I have to live next to her for the rest of my life? So as he's going off and off and off about all these things, am I going to argue with him? Am I just say, sure, yeah, yep. Do I want a confrontation? No. So what am I going to say?
Say yes and move on.
It could mean yes, but even that it might, yes might actually mean yes, but here's the problem with yes meaning yes. When I was in school, calculus was my hardest class, so I was scheduled study hall right after that. And boy, when the teacher was up there, he says, hey, does everybody understand how I did step one? Oh, yeah, it makes total sense. How about step two? Yeah, it makes sense. Step three, yeah, it makes sense. And did it make sense to me? Yes, it made total sense to me. But then 5 minutes later, I get to study hall, open my book, look at the first problem, and guess what?
Nothing.
So that's called passive listening. So I need him active. And that teacher really wanted to know that I got step one. He needed to say, what? Okay, then everybody, here's another example. Everybody do step one on this example. And that would make my neurons in my brain, what, actually connect the dots. Instead of just saying, yeah, I see how you did it, which is worthless, making me do it myself, is that going to stick longer or shorter?
Longer. This is
much longer.
So this is a little bit like the difference between a true-false question and an essay question when we're working with a client.
Yes, and that's the – so I was an expert at taking tests. I could have taken not even gone to a class and passed the class because I'm an expert at taking tests by knowing how they're put together and you eliminate two of them. It means but how did the teacher prevent people like me from skating? They always asked one kind of question at the end, which is what kind of answer? You just talked about it.
An essay question.
Essay, because I can't bluff there, can I?
Right.
So all of the questions motivational asks are not yes-no questions. They're open-ended questions where it's a complete thought answer. The client or the patient has to give a complete thought answer. Because here's the thing. If you could read people's minds, how many people would you sell?
All of them?
And here's what's sad. I don't know if I want that power.
Well, here's the great thing, is that you have that power, but you can use it only to know the things that you want to know that they're thinking. And what I mean by that is, if you ask them to open-ended question, and they give you a complete thought answer, an answer and a complete thought, guess what you know?
You know how they feel.
They know what they're thinking right then. Now, here's what science has told us. People won't say things that they don't believe, unless they're a pathological liar, and you don't want them as clients anyways. And are most people pathological liars?
No.
No. So most people will not say something they don't believe. If they'll say yes to something they don't believe, they'll say no to something they don't believe, but they will not verbalize. For example, if I go back to that the analogy of I'm a Democrat, my neighbor's a Republican, and he's going on and on and on about Obama and how he hates Obama, I'm going, sure, yeah, huh, yeah, right, uh-huh. But then if he says, yeah, why do you hate Obama? And if I don't hate Obama, guess what? I cannot physically find the means to do. I can't say it.
Yeah, start talking
my stomach will tighten up. I just can't say it. So if I really am a wimp and I don't want to get out, I'll say, yeah, I see what you're saying about Obama. See what I said there? Was that me saying or was I just saying, yeah, I see what you're saying there? So we do have certain what I call qualifying language to allow us to not tell the truth or not. But I teach the guys to listen for, yeah, I see what you're saying, or, you know, probably, or, yeah, it could be that way. Yeah, I could see how Obama could view Obama. Am I saying I agree then, or am I just saying I see what you're seeing?
Yeah, I can see how you think that.
I may say that if I'm a real wimp, but could I actually say, yes, I think that way about Obama too, if I don't?
No.
It's not happening.
No. So that's the thing about motivational interviewing. When you ask these questions, they're not going to say something they don't believe in. Now, back to your question, is this hard? I have guys tell me it's hard. It's hard to ask questions. I'm not used to asking questions. You ask a lot of questions. Like, I mean, I can't do that. And here's what the answer I give them. It's a little bit of a blunt answer, but I'm saying that's BS. Because here's the thing. If I fly down to your office, I'm going to sit in the corner with a loaded .45, and every time something other than a question, so if any statements comes out of your mouth, if anything other than a question comes out of your mouth, I'm going to shoot you in your kneecap. What would you magically be able to do? Now, look, I understand it's going to be difficult. So could there be some kind of awkward, weird questions?
Sure.
At first. Okay, do you think there would be some awkward, long silences at first as you go through in your mind, how do I turn what I want to say into a question? Do you think there might be some awkward, long silences?
Sure, mm-hmm. That would be uncomfortable.
Yeah, but here's the funny thing. Not 10 years, not 10 months, not 10 weeks, not 10 days, not even 10 hours, but 10 minutes later, after you make a focus of asking questions instead of making statements, guess what would magically start to happen? Your questions would get more awkward or less awkward?
Less.
And the awkward gaps would get longer or shorter?
I'm sure shorter.
Shorter. So it's not a matter of how hard it is, it's a matter of how much the guy wants to actually do it. But you know what we find? I've been just yapping and telling, preaching, teaching for years. So, you know, that's the easiest thing to do. I'll keep doing it. So if you want to change in your practice, guess what you have to do?
You got to change.
You got to change. Or you can make excuses. Guess what that got me for 8 years?
$50,000.
This is fantastic insight, Mike. We got to step out for a quick break. You're listening to Quantum Marketing Radio.
Are you independent? Be a part of the cutting edge in fixed life and annuity marketing for the independent agent and advisor. Discover the ECA Advantage, where you'll find the marketing systems, training, products, compensation, and expert support you need to take your business to the next level. Sign up for your free ECA agent account to get access to ECA's Knowledge is Power 2016 Keynote Speaker Video Series. For more information, call ECA Marketing today at 800-356-4189 and ask for your marketer, or visit ecamarketing.com.
And welcome back to Quantum Marketing Radio. I'm your host, Louis Hillman, alongside the Leverage Marketing Guy.
Hey, Jeff Thompson here.
And we are picking up our conversation with Mike Castleneck, the founder of the 5Q system. And Mike, appreciate all the great insight.
Super.
Yeah, Mike, you know, obviously you're giving us some very interesting contrarian sales strategy and tactics. How would we apply that to something like referrals? I know most agents, you know, think that's probably the best way to find business. But on the other hand, most are not very successful at it. You know, why is it that referrals don't work?
Well, it's not their fault that they don't work. And would you expect me to be anything but more contrarian when it comes to referrals?
I wouldn't.
So I just laugh. There's been thousands of articles written about referrals. There's been hundreds of books written about referrals, and they're all garbage. It's all the same crap recycled over and over and over again. You got the headline, oh, new referral technique, blah, 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 and you read it, and what is it? The same old tripe about, well, you know, you got when you first get the client, you got to let them know you're paid in two different ways and blah, 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 or you just want to ask for them or blah, 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 blah. When you guys have been in the business a long time, when's the last time you saw an original article written about how to get a referral or, and I'm not talking about what you do, Jeff, because that's not a referral. That's center of influence marketing, not referrals. I'm talking about getting referrals from my current client. When's the last time you read an article that had refreshing new information about referrals?
I can't say I have seen one.
I can't say I have either. What I was reading when I first got into sales in the 80s, I'm still reading today, but they pawned it off as some sort of, you know, lightning strike idea. Just garbage. Because referrals don't work. They're never going to work unless you can do one thing, and I'll show you what that is. But let's talk about why they don't work. Do you guys like rejection?
Not a bit.
How about the advisors you coach? Do they like rejection?
I have a feeling they don't even get to that point because they're afraid to have any conflict.
Exactly. So how do we get paid, though? By having to deal with what?
Rejection.
Rejection.
Yeah.
Now, if we don't like clients or rejection, and that's the way we make our livings, what do you think a client thinks about rejection when that's not how they make a living? Like it or hate it?
They're going to hate it.
They hate it. If we don't like it, how much do you think a client's going to hate it? A little or a lot?
A lot.
A lot. So when you go and ask a client for a referral, you know, a client goes and I get clients love us. They want to help us. But here's the funny thing. First time they go to their friend and say, hey, you know what? You should work with my guy because he's a really good guy and he's helped me retire. He's got this excellent software and he helped me set up my retirement to get the most income out of it. It's awesome. You need to talk to him. Guess what their friend says?
I've got a guy.
You should maybe talk to him. So then what happens to your client?
Yeah, it went nowhere.
I mean, so how many more times did they want to do that?
That was probably it.
That's it. So unless – now here's – now do some of our advisors get client, or get referrals? Yeah, here's when they get the referral. When their friend, when their relative walks, you know, says, hey, my guy just retired, or hey, I just moved here, or hey, I don't have an advisor and I'm retiring. Do you have somebody you can recommend? Then are our clients willing to recommend us?
Absolutely.
Absolutely they are. That's why we only get 4 or 5 referrals a year, because how are they coming? Is it because our advisor was, or our client was out looking to get us referrals, or somebody just asked them for some help or a referral?
They needed help.
Yeah. So until somebody can figure out a system where we can somehow get our clients, friends, neighbors, and relatives to ask our client for a referral, guess what's not going to work?
The whole idea of referrals, basically.
Yeah. Because until we can get over the whole rejection thing, it's not going to work. But I do have an idea that's worked fabulously for some guys to help get over that rejection thing. Because if you do find that 1 out of 10 clients who's willing to go out there proactively for you and make sure that not only are they not rejected, but they actually are treated as a center of influence, guess what will happen to that client then? Is he going to refer more or less? If he's, instead of being rejected, he's looked at as being the smart guy, the guy that has inside information. Which what do you think is going to happen to that guy? Do more or less referrals?
He's going to do more. He's going to thrive off of it.
Yeah. So here's the thing. You have to arm that person with what they need. If you want any chance of a client being proactive on referrals, you have to make sure they're never rejected. So you have to arm them with what to say. So how you arm them with what to say is you give them your elevator speech, if your elevator speech is phenomenal. And what... here's the definition of phenomenal. If at the end of when they give that person, you give the person the elevator speech, or they give the person the elevator speech, they say, really? How do you do that? Because if the person you give the elevator speech to says, hey, how do you do that? What have they just invited you to do?
Open the door. Yeah.
To sell them. Open the door to tell them how you work. But here's the thing. I hate talking about work to friends, neighbors, and relatives. So when I'm at a party and somebody asks, what do I do? Guess what I say? I'm a financial advisor.
So they go run away.
I help people with their retirement, blah, 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 blah. Which is the same thing as what?
Financial advisor. Yeah.
So what you need to do is find something that when you tell them, when somebody says, what do you do? Or when your client says, hey, blah, 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 people will say, how do you do that? Now, when your client hears their friend and relative say, how do you do that? How do you think that makes them feel?
Good,
because as human beings, do we like, I'm not necessarily saying this is the best trait of human beings, but do human beings like to be smarter than their neighbor?
For sure. Yeah.
Human beings like to know something that their neighbor doesn't know. Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. You want to have the keys to the secret treasure map.
Yeah. So when you do, then that makes you want to feel like that again, and you do another referral and another referral and another referral, because all these people want to know how you do it. So there's a 5-step process to creating a phenomenal elevator speech. The first thing you need to do is step one is that you need to figure out what makes you different. So, Jeff and Louis, how many advisors say that they, you know, I'm a really good investment advisor, a really good investment analyst, or whatever it may be? that they can choose investments really well?
Everyone.
Everyone. How many advisors say they can come up with really great income plans for their clients?
All of them.
How many advisors say that they are going to protect their clients from losing money or cushion the losses for their clients?
Yep, all of them.
Aren't they all safe money guys?
How many say that they care about their clients?
What's that?
All of them. So yeah. If we sound like every other advisor out there, guess what? It's not going to work. So when I'm saying you got to find something that's unique, let me tell you what's not unique. We have terrific service. We care about our clients. We're retirement experts. We're the IRN experts. We're the 401k experts. That's all what? Garbage.
It's Charlie Brown's teacher.
Find out. I'm sorry, Jeff, what?
It's Charlie Brown's teacher.
That's, yeah, wah, 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 wah. Right. Exactly. So you need to figure out what the one thing that you and only you do. Because if anybody else, any other advisor can make the exact same claim, guess what? It's worthless. You've started. Step one is worthless. So I don't care how much time and effort it takes. You better become an expert on something that nobody else in your area is an expert on. And don't tell me it's 401ks or IRAs or whatever else, or IULs, because guess how many IRA, 401k, and IUL experts there are in your territory? Everybody. Every single advisor is your competitor. So you need to find something that makes you unique. And actually, I think I'm going to be giving you a tool, Jeff and Louie, that you can offer to your guys afterwards that can actually, it's a series of 13 questions which will help them discover that one thing that makes them unique.
That's great. It sounds like that's obviously a difficult challenge in any business, but, you know, in our business, I think, because everybody has the exact same products on the shelf, it's especially difficult to do. So I'm sure they'll really appreciate that.
Yep. And can I say I've got this super special software?
Okay.
Oh, can I?
No.
Is that going to be different? No, because what do they hear? It's software. Guess what my guy has?
He can get that software, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's no, I mean, you're right. We can't say that we're the only people that have this software. We can't say we're the only person that has this money management. We can't say we're the only person that has this product, because we are a commodity, period. Mm-hmm. So there's a series of 13 questions that I walk guys through to help them discover the thing that at least none of their competitors can say. That's the first step. Now, what you're looking for after that, or even in conjunction with that, what you want to make that thing that you do better than anybody else and nobody else, not better, that you're the only person that does that thing, is you want to find something that keeps your clients up at night. So you're looking for one of three things: greed, fear, or frustration. So what keeps them up at night, you know, rubbing their hands together because they're so greedy and they can't wait to get that thing? In our business, that's a really hard thing to have, because are we limited or handcuffed on the types of returns and things that we can say our clients can get?
Absolutely.
So greed is pretty much out in our particular industry. But so you got to concentrate on what keeps them up at night because they're afraid, or what keeps them up at night because it frustrates them. Okay, so number one is find something that only you can claim. Number two is ask yourself, does it address something that pertains to their greed, their fear, or their frustration? And then number three is extremely important, and that is your elevator speech has to be extremely specific. For example, if I'm looking for a TV and I see an ad saying, for a store that sells everything, it says, everything on sale today, TVs, washers, dryers, whatever, what's the likelihood I'm going to rush down there and look at the TV set?
None.
Because you know what? It seems like every single week, what's that store saying?
Everything's on sale.
Right. But instead, I hear a store, if I'm in the market for a big screen TV and I hear a store say, listen, we're clearing out 10 of last year's 55-inch TV sets. We're selling them for 50 cents on the dollar. They're Panasonic model, you know, 57HCs, and any TV that we don't sell by the end of the day, we're going to gift them to the Boys and Girls Club of America. Now, if I'm in the market for a big screen TV, what would I do with that store?
There's cause to action.
Yeah, here's the thing. why is that believable where the other one isn't?
It's very specific.
Yeah, see, I think, hey, you know what? I could go see if that Panasonic really is last year's model. I could go see if it's very good or not. I could go see if it's really 50% off from the previous price. I could go all online if I wanted to, right? I could go down there at 4 o'clock and see, did they really give all the TVs that they had left to Boys and Girls Club? Not that I'll do it, though, any of those things, but if I make those specific claims, I think, or they make those specific claims, I think I can go check those things out. So obviously they wouldn't what?
They wouldn't lie.
They wouldn't lie. So now they're automatically what? Believable.
Yeah.
So it has to be specific. That's probably the most difficult thing that, well, they're all kind of difficult. You have to, this is coming up with an elevator speech that can make you hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars over your career. Do you think you're going to come up with that in 5 minutes? Or is it worth spending a couple of weeks mulling over and testing and coming up with more ideas and running things by people? Is it worth a couple of weeks of your effort? I'm not talking 8 hours a day. I'm talking about thinking about it, writing down notes, letting it go, then going back to it, and then letting it go, and then thinking more, and then, mulling it for 2 weeks or so. Is it worth that kind of investment?
For sure. It's building your own personal brand.
Yes. So it's worth all the time and effort to make sure it's going to work. Okay? The fourth, so number one is something that only you can claim. No other advisor could say they actually do that thing. And it should address number two, something that addresses a client's greed, fear, frustration. Third thing is the elevator speech has to be extremely specific. And I'll give you an example here in a bit. Fourth thing is it repeatable? Is it something that a client could say back? If you want referrals, it better be something your client can what?
You want them to be able to feed it to their network.
To feed
so,
it. Yeah. Right. And then the fifth thing is the test, and that is when you do it, when you use that particular elevator speech, what I use as the litmus test of whether it's successful or not is if 5 out of 10 times people say, how do you do that? Because if your client went and 5 out of 10 times talked to 10 people and sent 5 people to you, how happy would you be?
I think that'd be a good ratio.
Home run.
Yes. So if you have a great one, it could be higher than that. But if it's below 5 out of 10 or below 50%, where they say, how do you do that? You got to go back to the drawing board and start all over again. So let me give you an example of a 5K elevator speech that I created for an advisor in New Mexico that he used and created $350,000 of income in 6 months using it. Okay?
That sounds interesting. Let's hear it.
So remember, we need to be something only I can claim. None of my competitors are claiming it. Has to address greed, fear, or frustration. Has to be extremely specific. Has to be something that's repeatable. And it has to be something where people would say, how do you do that? It ended up, this guy was working in the teacher market. And New Mexico had passed a law that not everybody knew about that addressed teachers' pensions in that state. So this is the elevator speech we came up with. So I increased a teacher's retirement pension income by an average of $430 a month by utilizing the new changes in New Mexico's teacher statute 256B. So how many of his competitors do you think were saying that?
Zero.
How specific was it? I said teacher's retirement pension, there's one level of specificity. Increase income by $430 a month, there's a second level of specificity. Teacher statute 256B, third level of specificity, all in one sentence. So how specific is that?
Very, and it sounds very believable.
And then guess what? When he taught his teacher clients to do that, and teachers, he and I worked together, came up with a unique little reward system for the teachers that did this or referred in. But when they went in the teacher's break room and they said, hey, you should talk to my guy. Have you heard about New Mexico's teacher statute 256B? No, why? Oh, my guy I'm working with, he helped me increase my pension by $430 a month for the rest of my life when I retire by utilizing that. It just changed. Did you know that was happening? And guess what? Over and over happened. Guess what? When the teacher would do that to another teacher, guess what the teacher would say?
How do you do that?
Yep. Oh, well, I guess my guy could talk. You want to talk to my guy? Here, here's his card.
Yeah, so he had basically viral referrals.
Yes, and the reason he had viral referrals is because was that teacher experiencing rejection when they're making the referral?
Zero.
Yep.
Zero rejection.
So that's the only way a referral is going to work, is if you can come up with an elevator speech where the person who's doing the referring is not rejected. So often have you seen that in all the thousands of articles and hundreds of books have been written on referrals. So all those things have been setting the advisor up for failure with referrals because they're setting their clients up for rejection, and clients aren't having rejection. So you got to come up with a great elevator speech that makes sure your client doesn't receive that rejection, but instead receives that. Really? How do you do that? Or what's that? Or how does that work? And do you think you could use this in your real life?
For sure.
Do you have to have a referral? Could you use it in your as an advisor?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you put it on your stationery. You put it on your business card. Heck, you can even put it on a bumper sticker, and then every time you go into a Target or go into a Walmart, guess what you do? Put a stack of your business cards with that bumper sticker on your bumper. Put a stack of your business cards on the bumper. So when people read that bumper sticker and wonder how you do that, they'll grab your business card. And you can do all sorts of things if you have it. Because if they really want to know how do you do that, guess what? Now you have people seeking you out for that information. If I put a bumper sticker on my car saying, I'm a great IRA specialist, I'll help you our IRA grow. What do they think of that crap?
Yeah, they're not listening again. So it's not differentiated. It's not specific. It's violating all the rules you just laid out.
Yeah.
So, well, it's very interesting hearing all this contrarian approach to sales and marketing and branding your business and this whole elevator process. I'm sure most agents have no idea how to do any of this. And probably need some guidance. So you said you're going to make a tool available for people to kind of get a head start on this and walk them through a process?
Yeah, I'll get it to you guys over there, and then you guys can, if somebody emails you or calls you and wants that that guide on how to create your own effective elevator speech, that you can get that to them.
Okay, well, we can actually, we'll probably, with the podcast episode here, we'll just make it available on the podcast page for people to access or request there. So, well, great. Anything else you wanted to cover today, Mike or Louie?
Yeah, and Mike, if we'll be able to get information to advisors that are interested in taking a look at the 5Q marketing system, they can get that on ECA's homepage, and we can help direct them to that link. I just want to say that I really appreciate your time. I love the fact, and I've been following your stuff for a couple of years, Mike, is your work with the sales process. I think too many people are focused on marketing and just putting out some sort of marketing campaign without having a process, and you've developed a very successful process for the producers you work with. It's great to have this kind of background insight.
Yeah, I think our listeners are really going to enjoy just hearing about this contrarian model, and it's a major innovation in the sales process, probably in not just our industry, but really in any industry. So it's really fun to hear what you have to offer, and I'm sure a lot of agents will be interested in learning more.
Well, I appreciate you having me on. I guess I'd just leave with this one thought. Don't try to be better. Be different.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for downloading our podcast. Find out more about the Quantum Marketing System at quantummarketingsystem.com.